720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for joining us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday afternoon with me. Lots to do on the show today. We are going to be talking in just a bit about mindfulness in the workplace and some strategies that you can put to work right away to make your day a little bit less stressful, hopefully. And we're going to be taking a look at how cab drivers and rideshare workers, although their relationship has been a very contentious one, they have teamed up behind a common cause, and we're going to be looking at that as well as the downfall of the Treasure Island store here in Chicago. A lot of people were talking about that on social media. But before we get to all that, we're joined right now by Gerald Porter, consumer reporter at Bloomberg, who wrote about the rise of an industry we don't necessarily think of as an industry, and that is the big business of yoga pants. Seems like a very innocuous item, right? A thing that a lot of us own. However, it is a multi-billion dollar industry. There is a great deal of science and engineering and fabric tech and all this stuff behind it that has really fueled this humongous industry. So joining us to talk about that, welcome to the program, Gerald Porter.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy. It's a pleasure.
So talk us through this, because, you know, I think it's just sort of out of nowhere that it went from a fairly, you know, innocuous item. The first time it seemed like when people got very passionate about yoga pants was when someone wrote an article talking about, hey, women should not be wearing yoga pants in public unless they are exercising. And that's when suddenly we started seeing a lot of, a lot of feelings around yoga pants and a lot of people taking sides around them. But this is a whole other level, talking about kind of the business side and the industry that has sprung up around this and all of the care with regard to like the technical fabric and how they are engineered and all that has sprung up. So talk us through that, if you would.
Absolutely. I mean, the beauty in this trend is that it was very much consumer-driven. So a lot's happened since 1998 when Lululemon had their first yoga pant come out in the market, but with folks wearing them not for yoga purposes, you know, to walk to the store, to make that quick grocery run, or just on the car, take the kids to school. It's really showing that customers are really believing in the feeling that comes with yoga pants. And so with 11,000 yoga pants on the market, at this point in time, with billions of dollars in looks for them to stand on, there's really a yoga pant for everybody. So brands are really taking notice.
You know what? I'm going to put you on hold for 1 second. It sounds like maybe you're breaking up a little bit, and we're going to troubleshoot some of your audio there for just a second. But, after the program, if you follow me on Twitter, I am going to tweet this story out from Bloomberg because I want you to read it for yourself, because it's really, really fascinating, because it's not just about like all of the pieces that go into a yoga pants business, including like hiring scientists to engineer fabric and how Lululemon has kind of championed that and looked at a lot of different ways to, update the fabric they were originally using, things like that. But also really around the consumer demand and how that even in the workplace, that's sort of shifting into a culture that perhaps is a little more accommodating to people that might want to be wearing like athleisure wear and that kind of thing. But I want to back up a little bit, Gerald, and talk about like what drove you to write this story initially.
Well, my colleague Kim Bassine and I were really just looking at the 20th anniversary of Lululemon and seeing, well, how far has this pant really come? And so once we really started to dig deep and, you know, look across the industry and see that Nike, Adidas, and even Target were some of the latecomers to this race to get the yoga pants into the market, it was very interesting. And so we decided, well, 11,000 types of yoga pants is a whole lot now, but that never was what's the case. And so we really saw that there were a lot of transitions and evolutions with the pant. And so we decided that, you know, it should be good to cover this and really help people see that they've been around just as much as people think, because we see them on everyone and every day pretty much at this point. But we really thought that there was room to show the business side of this and how brands have been approaching it.
Yeah, it is a really interesting story. And again, for those of you who follow me on social media, I'll be sure and share it after the show so you can read it for yourself, because there's a lot of really interesting data points in that. But I want to shift to kind of taking a look at the cultural part of that, because it still seems like there is a bit of polarity around this, right? There's either, hey, my workplace is shifting a little bit and this is the kind of environment in which we can kind of wear whatever we want, or absolutely not. It doesn't seem like there's much middle ground. And so we see things like immediately I'm thinking of brands like Beta Brand, who made it's yoga pants, but it's sort of disguised to look like dress pants and things like that, because it seems like there's a push-pull here.
Yeah, and I can say that, you know, with what folks wear them for, whether it be for fitness or for leisure or the transition between both, it's one of those concepts where folks really are dressing it up or dressing it down on a case-by-case basis. So whether you're going to the gym and you don't want to change out of those yoga pants or you want to just switch into something more comfortable, or if you're just in the office and you know you have something long and flowy over it, I mean, it's a very versatile pant, so people are really very flexible in terms of how they approach their wardrobes. But I do recall being in school at one point and yoga pants were an issue because it was a visibility thing and, you know, folks weren't really sure how they should approach this new pant that just popped out and was replacing jeans.
Yeah, it does seem, I mean, they do seem like yoga pants are far more commonplace than jeans at this point. It doesn't seem like when people go to extremely casual wear to just kind of like pop around and run errands, and it's probably going to be athletic wear over like jeans and a t-shirt, which I think was the standard for a long time.
And I would definitely say so. I mean, activewear at the moment is a $48 billion industry, and a lot of it has been driven by yoga pants, but it's part of this ongoing trend where, you know, consumers are really believing in the comfort and feeling that they're getting with their clothes. And so you see it with there being a yoga pant for everybody these days, and brands really took notice. So activewear has become a big investment for a lot of different brands, whether it be Target, Nike, or Adidas. I mean, even just this past week, Kohl's said they were going to be updating their activewear inventory at stores by 40%. So it's a hot commodity for folks these days.
Yeah, and I thought it was very interesting in the piece how you note that companies studied different uses, that it wasn't, they realized quickly, you know what, this one fabric fits all situation is not going to work. We need to make a different product for a dancer versus a yoga practitioner versus a runner or a cyclist. I think that's really fascinating of just how much technical skill is going into each of these products, even if they just look all the same.
And it was quite revealing when we did the research, but it all makes sense when you see how much consumers are really driving brands' approach to this pant. So, I mean, people will wear them for yoga, but sometimes that form-fitting tight pant doesn't work if you're trying to just run or if you're trying to do something else. So you might need a looser pant or a different material. So whether or not it's just the Luon legging or, you know, Lululemon's Luxtreme, their New Lux, Adidas's ClimaCool or ClimaWarm, there's some type of technical aspect that's being addressed with these pants that really gives customers the biggest bang for their buck when they're buying them.
Very interesting stuff. And like I said at the top, it seems like such an innocuous little item sitting in the closet, but nonetheless, it is big business behind it. And so I'll be sure and share this after the program so you can read it for yourself. It is very, very interesting. Gerald Porter, consumer reporter at Bloomberg, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Amy. It was a great pleasure.
Anytime. All right, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about mindfulness techniques that you can incorporate into your workday to bring it down a notch and make it a little bit less stressful. All that and more, I'm back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Thanks for being with us. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch and the Allstate Skyline Studio. Beautiful day here in the city of Chicago. Lots to do on the program still. Plenty, plenty of things to talk about. We are joined now by phone by David Gelis, columnist at New York Times and author of Mindful Work, How Meditation is Changing Business from the Inside Out. Very, very interesting topic when we think about mindfulness at work, because we're also bombarded with so many messages about doing more, being more, when we're already, so many of us are already kind of stressed to the max. So this topic of mindfulness at work is a very, very relevant and interesting one. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me back.
So where do we even start with this? Because it seems like we are all kind of constantly in a state of overwhelm so often that it's a bit the norm. And I've talked many times on this program about the sort of the cult of busyness and how it's so fashionable and chic to be busy. And downtime is kind of this strange rarity now. But where do we start in our workplace with mindfulness?
Well, I think we can start at the present moment. You know, let's start right here, right now, just stopping whatever it is we're about to do, letting go of whatever it is that just happened, and instead just come into the present moment. You know, that alone is sort of a radical act. It's something that so few of us do on a daily basis. And yet when we actually take the time to come into our bodies, to notice our breath, to actually experience what this present moment is, all sorts of remarkable things can happen.
That is so very, very true. And this is a topic I think about a lot personally. And so where does the meditation piece of that come in, especially, you know, in a workplace where, you know, it's probably not appropriate to just stop and chill for a minute, at least not visibly so. How do you begin to move that into your workday?
Yeah, well, you'd be surprised how much free time there really is in the middle of even a busy workday. You know, when we think of meditation, we don't need to think of sitting cross-legged on a cushion for an hour or even 45 minutes at a time. Instead, I would invite everyone to think about looking for these small moments. And if we can practice small moments many times throughout the day, all of a sudden we can sort of string together this necklace of jewels of these sort of bright moments where we're actually present. We're actually in this moment rather than caught up in all the busyness, when we might actually be able to get in touch with ourselves and actually sense how we're doing and ultimately become a little less stressed, a little happier, maybe even a little more productive in the long run.
I like it. I like the sound of all of this. What about, and this is something you wrote about recently, and for those of you who follow me on social media, I'm going to be sure to tweet this out after the program because I want you to try all of these wonderful ideas. I would love to talk with you about what you said and what you wrote about bringing mindfulness into meetings, because I think that is a thing a lot of people dread and a lot of people kind of roll their eyes at as kind of this necessary evil and this kind of thing, well, we got to do it. But I love the idea of there being real, you know, solid strategies in place for having a more focused and meaningful experience in a meeting.
Yeah, let's talk specifics. And meetings are not the easiest place to begin, because really, when you're in a meeting, you're asking a lot of other people to participate with you, which is it's not as easy as just doing it on yourself. For example, deciding that as your computer is booting up, you're actually not going to scroll Instagram on your phone, but instead you're actually just going to take a moment to be present. Meetings are more challenging because we're asking other people to participate with us in this collective exercise of presence. But there are some tips that we offer in this guide, How to Be More Mindful at Work, which just went up on the New York Times a couple days ago. And here are a few of them. One obvious one is just to say, listen, we're not going to be looking at our phones while we're in this meeting. So if you're in this meeting, you're in this meeting. You're not checking your email. You're not looking at Twitter. So put down the phone. If you're going to be in this meeting, pay attention. Another further step could be, and listen, that extends to computers as well. Now, a lot of people say, well, I need to be looking at my computer. I need to be taking notes. But listen, if you need notes from the meeting, have one person delegated as essentially the secretary, the note taker, and then circulate those notes afterwards. And all of a sudden, everyone is paying a bit more attention. And then finally, another thing you can try is to actually give everyone in the room the opportunity to speak. Not to make sure everyone has to have a presentation to give, but at least recognize who is in the room and make sure everyone feels acknowledged and given the opportunity to speak. And these tips come from a woman named Janice Martirano. She was one of the first people I wrote about when I started covering mindfulness in business almost 10 years ago. And she rightly said, and from good experience, she was vice general counsel at General Mills, big, big food company, had a big job. She said, meetings can be an incredible waste of time when people aren't really listening. If one eye is on your phone when you're in a meeting, you're really not there. So these are her tips for staying present.
Things we can all get behind, for sure. Now, talk to me about the stop technique. That is a really interesting one, I think, that a lot of people can take with them as well.
Stop is another one of these helpful exercises that circulate pretty widely in sort of the mainstream mindfulness communities. And these are simple acronyms that suggest a set of steps we can take to, again, just remember to come back to the present moment. Mindfulness is really all about coming back, being in this moment, not getting caught up in thoughts of the future, not dwelling in the past, but approaching right here, right now, with an accepting, non-judgmental state of mind. And so STOP, S-T-O-P, is a simple exercise that is just a reminder to come back to the present moment. So the S is for stop. Just take a moment, no matter what you're doing. The T is for take a breath. Actually feel the sensation of our own breathing. I mean, when was the last time any of us did that? We're breathing all the time. And yet, how often do we feel our lungs inhaling and exhaling, our chest rising and falling as we do that? The O is for observe. Just notice what is happening, for good or bad, inside and out, in a non-judgmental, simple way. Just feel whatever it is you feel. And then the P is for proceed. Having checked in with yourself, just continue on with whatever it is you are doing. But it's about habituating that ability to just stop and take a moment to reflect that over the long run, we know scientifically, can have big changes on our disposition for the better. Stop, take a breath, observe, and proceed.
That is exactly what I was just about to ask you next, and that is, what are the results of this? I think we all know it feels better when we're in this state, but what data are we looking at and that you are you finding that really supports the case for doing this, and not just the workplace, but in throughout our lives?
In my book, Mindful Work, How Meditation is Changing Business from the Inside Out, I conducted a pretty rigorous examination of a huge amount of the scientific literature that has come out over the last 30 years that really examines what happens in the brain and the body when we practice mindfulness meditation. And the results really aren't in dispute at this point. You know, for as much as we might like to think that mindfulness and meditation are still some sort of fringe elements, the science would suggest otherwise. And we now know that if you practice simple, secular, that is to say non-religious, we're not practicing a religion here, this is just a mental exercise of coming back to the present moment instead of getting caught up in our thoughts. If we can actually do that over a sustained amount of time for as little amount of time as a couple weeks, we start to see meaningful changes in our stress, in our health, and in our mental health. And so biometric indicators of physical stress, things like heart rate variability and cortisol levels, these are the markers in our body that tell us, tell scientists, that we're wound up in a potentially really unhealthy way. They start to go down. And over the long term, we can see in fMRI studies, that is to say, you know, scans of the brain, we can start to see that in areas like the prefrontal cortex of our brain, this is the area responsible for higher order processing, our reasoning, our higher order language and functions, that there's more gray matter. That is to say, there's more activity there. And so we can see that in the minds of meditator, the areas that are really responsible for these critical functions are more developed. They're more robust. So we know that there's long-term health and mental wellness implications here.
Indeed, indeed. And again, the name of the book is Mindful Work, How Meditation is Changing Business from the Inside Out. David Gelis, thank you so much for being with us again today.
Thank you, Amy.
All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. So we are joined now by Robert Chanik, media and business reporter at Chicago Tribune, regular contributor to this program. I would also add, he wrote about how cabbies and rideshare workers, two groups that I think we can all agree that have had some contentious interactions in the past, certainly in this city, have joined forces recently to protest the rising number of rideshare drivers in the city. Robert, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Amy. Great to be with you.
So talk us through this, because these seem like two very unlikely allies that would be behind any cause. But how did this all come about?
Well, good question. Yeah, they certainly, you know, cab drivers and cab owners will make it clear to you that their business has been deteriorating in recent years because of the growth of rideshare companies, Uber and Lyft, and they've taxi licenses in Chicago are limited. There's about 6,999 exactly licenses, medallions out there in the market, and about half of the cabs right now are idled. They're either in foreclosure or just off the streets because business is so bad for cabbies. So it's, their world has changed dramatically, as we've seen, and everyone who drives or walks in Chicago sees all those Lyft and Uber cars out there, flooding the streets. So they obviously, cabbies have had an issue with this new competition that has meant fewer regulations. There's no limits at this point on the number of rideshare drivers out there, and they say it's cut into their business. And of course, you got changing habits too. A lot of younger people certainly don't think about cabs. They use their apps and they hail a ride. But now all of a sudden, these rivals have a common cause, because the existing drivers are starting to say, yeah, there's too many out there. We it's hard to make a living. So they're all on the same page suddenly, at least a certain number of drivers from both sides, saying that we need regulations to limit the number of rideshare licenses out in the streets of Chicago. So I said, these two people that have been going at it are suddenly together saying to City Hall, we need change.
And so what has that approach been like? And is there any sign that this will be effective?
Well, they had a rally Wednesday morning at City Hall, which I jokingly said was probably the best place in Chicago to hail a ride Wednesday morning, because you had dozens of cabbies and Uber and Lyft drivers cruising around City Hall. But, who's to say? They're trying to get legislation similar to a legislation that passed in New York, which put a one-year moratorium on rideshare licenses. Don't quote me, I think it was in the late summer, and also was going to take a look at how to increase revenue for the rideshare drivers. And they want, the rideshare folks specifically want to see that. They want to see limits. I think the total that I got from the city, there's 67,000 active Uber and Lyft drivers on the streets of Chicago right now. So it's not your imagination. You are seeing a lot of them if you're out and about. And they're hoping that the aldermen will, introduce legislation similar to New York and cap the number of rideshare drivers. And, of course, taxi drivers think that's a good thing, too.
Right. And so I want to look at this New York legislation a little bit deeper. What does that one-year cap look like? Is that limiting the length of time one can be a driver, or does that create a process to kind of restart every year?
Right now, as far as I know, and I'm, have a very rough view of what they're doing, I couldn't give you great details, but it was basically just to buy a year, as I understood it, while they assess the situation and say, we're not going to let anyone else drive, have a rideshare license in New York for 1 year while we try to figure out what the right course of action is. So I don't think there's anything sort of definitive other than just to put it on hold while they try to ascertain what the best course of action is. And that's also, in essence, what Chicago rideshare drivers and taxi drivers in this instance are looking for. Just put the whole thing on hold and let's figure out what to do.
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic. And I think a theme that comes up a lot on this program is when suddenly user behavior and technology attached to it moves so quickly, suddenly we see kind of the human toll of that, and then suddenly people are asking for change. I think we see that a lot with social media. We see, that's a theme that echoes a lot. So it'll be interesting to keep an eye on this. And of course, we will keep turning to you for the latest to see what happens and how this unfolds. It is a really interesting topic, especially, we talked a couple of months ago on this show about how rideshare has influenced traffic patterns in the city. When we look at the number you said, 67,000 active rideshare, that's a whole heck of a lot of cars suddenly out a lot. So certainly.
And just so you know, that's one of the arguments being made for limiting it, is that concerns about, congestion, and certainly seems to be a legitimate concern when you have, and a lot of the rideshare drivers are part-time, just to make it clear. That's what the Uber and Lyft take is. They're not all, on the streets at once per se, but it's still a lot of cars cruising around the city that probably wouldn't be there without the rideshare business, you know?
That's right. Certainly an uptick when already traffic is mighty frustrating. So,
for sure.
Robert Chanek, thanks so much for being with us. We will keep turning to you for the latest. And for those of you who follow me on social media, I'm going to be sure and share this story after the program. Thanks so much, Robert.
All right. Thanks a lot, Amy.
All right. We're going to take a little break. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today. We're joined now by Bridget Sweeney, another regular contributor to this program, who is a consumer reporter at Crain's Chicago, who wrote recently about the downfall of Treasure Island, the Chicago-based grocery chain founded in the 1960s. There was great outcry on social media when it was announced that this store was closing. I think people kind of considered it a pillar. Nonetheless, the announcement was made. Bridget, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Amy, thanks so much for having me.
Certainly. So talk us through all of this and what led to this. I think we've talked about so many retailers, up against online retail, things like that. Was that the case here, or was that another factor?
Well, that's a great question. In the case of Treasure Island, it was definitely a combination of two factors. One, the kind of onward march of retail technology and, the fact that Amazon has teamed up with Whole Foods and Mariano's and Kroger, and these big grocery conglomerates have really ramped up what they're able to offer to customers, which really makes it much harder for smaller players like Treasure Island. That is the reason that the Treasure Island management voiced when they announced they were closing down in early October. But that is certainly not the only reason. As it became very clear from talking to employees and from former court documents over the decades, there's been a pretty consistent and somewhat outrageous pattern of mismanagement at Treasure Island almost ever since it began.
In the story that you wrote at ChicagoBusiness.com, and for those of you who follow me on social media, I'll be sure and share it after so you can read it for yourself. It opens with this very charming picture of the chain of the store's, original idea, and the moment in time and of what was happening right then, I think was interesting to note. In particular, you note with this wonderful line, it was just as Americans loosened their grips on Jell-O molds and got to know Brie and extra virgin olive oil. And also it coincided. It was kind of right after we got the Mastering the Art of French Cooking from Julia Child. And so perhaps it was kind of this moment where people were wanting something and this store stepped in to fill that void.
Absolutely. And the family who opened Treasure Island, the Camberos family, absolutely deserves credit for kind of seeing that coming and intuiting what customers wanted, which, as we know, is a hallmark of successful retailers going back to, the 19th century. So the Camberos brothers were the sons of Greek immigrants who grew up poor on the West Side. Their father sold produce from a pushcart on the West Side. And they kind of realized, post-war, they realized that, this is right when people are getting more technology, more dishwashers and things that are making their life easier. And, their Julia Child, as you mentioned in the story mentions, she was kind of coming to prominence and showing middle-class Americans that they can, do French cooking and they can explore. And there's all these ways that you can really elevate what you're eating every day. And Treasure Island captured that that sense of discovery and that sense of making shopping not a chore, but really an adventure. And honestly, from talking to people who shopped at the stores in the 60s and 70s and talking, reading accounts that were published back then, it was bigger than Whole Foods. It was such a wonderful place that people were excited by. Shoppers told me, every time we walked in the store, there was something new, there was something exotic. Kids who were growing up in the 60s whose fathers had, fought in World War II and had been overseas a lot, they would be able to find ingredients that they had experienced, overseas that they didn't even know were available in America. So it was a really heady time. And Chris Camberos, who was kind of the main guy, he took buying trips, He was and his partner Bill Allen. They just were kind of marketing geniuses, and they just knew what customers wanted.
And so, at its at one point, as you note in the story, it was this $100 million in annual revenue. Institution. It really did a lot of business for all the reasons that you mentioned, and I'm sure many more. And so what led from that point in the 90s to now, where we've hearing about lawsuits and angry creditors and that kind of thing? What was that? Where was where were the big turning points in that process?
Right. Well, the first visibility we really get into trouble in the company comes from lawsuits that were filed in the early 90s between the partners. So in addition to the two Ken Barros brothers, this Bill Allen, the third partner, the Ken Barros brothers sued him, saying that he was basically stealing money from the company. For listeners who may recall a certain lounge in the 680 North Lakeshore building, it was called the Gold Star Sardine Bar. It was actually in the building that Treasure Island opened in as well. Bill Allen was totally the guy behind that bar. It was such a cool kind of lounge, like very famous jazz singers all the time. Anyway, the Ken Barros brothers say that he took money from Treasure Island to fund that bar, and just in generally was taking money and kicking back money to the tune of somewhere between $1.5 and $2 million. The controller kicked back fought back and said, hey, no, the Ken Barros brothers are taking money. They're literally taking money out of the cash register. They're, committing fraud with coupons in the Tribune and then, the Sunday papers, all sorts of things. So it was really this messy back and forth. Long story short, the Ken Barros brothers buy out Bill Allen. He winds up, on probation. The Ken Barros brothers continue on, but there were all these allegations of, again, just kind of mismanagement. Back in the 90s, there were lots of city violations for outdated food, for overpricing food, all sorts of things. So all of those things kind of came to light, even as Treasure Island was still kind of in its heyday. But then, again, by the 2000s, when the first Whole Foods actually opened in the 1990s in Chicago, and there was also another store that was eventually bought up by Whole Foods. So there were this kind of onslaught of other high-end offerings. And so at that point, even in the Tribune back in the mid-1990s, there were stories kind of saying, hey, is Treasure Island losing its footing to these new up-and-comers? But again, they hung in there for so long because there was nostalgia for these stores. They still offer kind of interesting, quirky offerings. But as I found out from talking to current employees, apparently the redating of food and all sorts of other things has continued to this day and seems like it really did cause problems. And, it's hard to, you can't really allege that they made people sick because, people who worked at the store said that they would get complaints from customers saying that they ate something from the deli that was, improperly dated. But again, it's impossible to confirm those things. But the redating of the items was told to me and shown via photos to me by multiple employees.
Very interesting. And yet, it seemed as if this came as a shock, the announcement that the store was closing. It seemed like it came as a complete shock to people. Last month, I remember seeing and then digging into it and searching a bit on social media, there was really people felt like this is the end of an era. People really felt very attached to this store, and there was a lot of conversation around that. And did it, just in the business sense, did it seem like the closing of the store was as surprising as consumers seem to take it, or did you see this coming, or did others see this coming?
Right. I have to say, I did not see it coming. Kind of interestingly, I used to be a somewhat regular Treasure Island shopper. I live close to the store in the Gold Coast on Elm Street, and people who live in that area, know that the Big Jewel on the corner of Clark and Division, it was shut down for a couple of years for renovation. So for a while, that Treasure Island was really the main grocery store in the neighborhood. But once the new Jewel opened more than a year ago, that became my go-to. So I had not been in Treasure Island very often, but people who remained committed shoppers did say that starting in early 2018, the inventory just got really wonky, and they noticed bare shelves, or they noticed things not being restocked. And, of course, that we come to find out that was due to the fact that they were not paying their vendors in a timely fashion. So they were literally doing kind of inventory roulette, like moving inventory from store to store, depending on which store got which delivery when, based on who got paid when, so that they could kind of make it seem like everything was fine. So it became this very intricate dance that they undertook to try and kind of cover up the fact that they weren't paying vendors, they weren't getting as much food. But still, despite that, the fact that the actual closure, it came down so quickly. Employees found out September 28th, which I believe is a Friday. It was a Friday. And they had no idea. So, and they didn't get severance. You know, they didn't really get much notice at all. So there were signs, but at the same time, it was still shocking nonetheless.
Nonetheless. All right. Bridget Sweeney, consumer reporter at Crain's Chicago. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about this story today. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks so much, Amy.
All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.